We're in a pub. I'm drinking with today's guest on the All About Symbian podcast. Where else would I be in London drinking, doing a tech interview, but with L'Enfant Terrible, because I don't know any really good swearing in Polish. It's Mr. Andrew Orlowski.
Hello, Ian, and hello, everyone.
Yes, Andrew Orlowski, famous from The Register and The Register and...
I think I've been there forever, but I wasn't the first employer. There were actually a couple of people, Tony Smith, Lucy Sheriff, who is still with us, who have been on and off there from the start. So, relatively speaking, there were a few people joined before I joined. I was one of the few during the nuclear winter of the dot-com bubble, so maybe I was more prominent than I deserved to be when there were just four writers and we were furiously typing away.
So the fact that you've bought 16 gin and tonics, 5 Newcastle brown ales, and got me a half a shandy, does that mean that the bubble's back for the Register or for Britain as a whole?
We're doing well. We stuck around. I mean, the foolish thing that a lot of publishers did during the big crash of about 2001 was to close up and go home. And, you know, some publishers spent more money closing their titles than we ever spent setting up the Register, and it was very short-sighted, and publishers kind of do this, but we always figured if we can just sort of weather it out, we'll be okay, and we're okay now.
Lovely. Isn't that a lovely end to a story? What are you doing being British? So we're here mainly because of an article that you wrote. I say an article, it was as long as a Cory Doctorow short story, wasn't it, on Scion. At the start of the week, 17,845 words, I believe, on the history of, as you put it, Britain's last computer company.
Well, it's actually most of those words aren't by me, so I was probably about 5,000 R. Fortunately, it was actually done and dusted in about 3 or 4 days. I was very fortunate in that the first person I interviewed was the legendary Mark Gretton, who's justifiably fated as our best silicon chip designer. Now at TomTom, of course, and he designed the silicon for the Series 3, the Series 5, lots and lots of other projects. Lots of things which don't even make it onto his CV are kind of legendary. Mark opened up and for 2 hours told me the Scion story from start to finish, and I realised I had a little bit more than 1,000-word anniversary piece here.
And you're telling me before, we were kind of sharing war stories of the bits of kit that we knew Scion had, but were never public.
I mean, that isn't the story. That was nice to do, you know, get put things to the code words. But the interesting thing for me was the sheer variety of consumer electronics products which Scion could have produced and brought to market at a time when it was valued on the London Stock Exchange as a company worth several billion.
Well, let's be fair here. FTSE 100 listed.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's a very British story. It has all the ingenuity, inventiveness, and improvisation of really great British engineering and some of the kind of cautiousness and fatalism that affects British companies. For some reason, we don't think we can do it here. Maybe we enjoy complaining too much and grumbling too much, but Scion could have had it all, I think, and that's a great story.
So, we got you here is, of course, you look back at Scion now, and really what people remember Scion for is they did the first bits that became Symbian, which is in 125 million plus devices nowadays. Now, in the article, you talk about how Symbian effectively gutted parts of Scion, but I really wanted to spin down and maybe if you go into a bit more depth on what Symbian was up to in those formative years. I mean, they were announced, if I get my dates right, they announced themselves in 1999, and Scion kind of spluttered out of existence in, well, Scion is still there with TechLogic, but the Scion that we would regard as Scion kind of spluttered out in 2001-2002.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I didn't have time to go into was, of course, Scion's re-entry into the PDA business, because a few months after, there might be people whose sort of memory is fuzzy or just don't know the story at all. Scion invented lots and lots of things, actually. Things like power-saving BIOS, which is in, like, every computer now. The world would be unimaginable without it. The first uses of flash memory and the flash memory bus. It never liked patenting things, so alone as an IP property, if it had patented it, it would be, you know, worth a lot of money. For the Series 5 computer, it did it did a brand new operating system from scratch and a brand new hardware platform from scratch. And I contend that this is the last time anyone's ever done this. Of course, people make computers and they call them games. I mean, you can say the PlayStation has had a billions of investment. It's got a new chip, radically new chip, new hardware platform, obviously new operating system to run it. But that's a games console. I think this is the last time, unless the economics of the world changes, that anybody does a general purpose computer from scratch. So one of the assets that Cyan had was this new, amazing new operating system, which it floated off to a consortium of phone manufacturers.
And they did keep 28% for themselves.
They kept 28% for themselves, yes. And the market shone on them for doing that. One of the aspects was that this is a year after the Series 5 had been launched, and of course Cyan found itself with no software engineers, so it wasn't fatal, but it did hold them up for quite a bit while they had to restaff.
And Symbian at this time, of course, was going through a huge amount of growing pain as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some great stories in that article from Nick Healy, who suddenly describes making a product and lots of very intelligent and passionate people thinking about very pixel-level detail problems. I mean, if you meet any of these guys, they're very, very passionate about, you know, where the menu key should go and the total user experience. And that's all been lost now. I don't think we have that pretty much anywhere in the world, except for maybe Apple kind of cares about the consumer. And to me, that's the missing... I don't want to take the Symbian achievement away from anybody, but one thing that's missing in this kind of economic model, which has its good parts and it delivers billions of cheap phones to the world. The downside is the manufacturers don't really care about the quality of the product at the end of the day, because we're not the customers and we have to put up with these terrible design decisions, Q&A and so on.
Yeah, I mean, certainly an issue, I think it was your review, which was, why does every single menu command on the new communicator hang off one key?
Yes. I mean, to me, actually, that was the feedback at all about Symbian. There was a very strong kickback to this is the one that's going to make all the old Cyan users happy. One of the best comments in the feature was Nick Healy's, who said...
Everybody's now going, oh, that Nick Healy in the comments.
No, sorry. Nick Healy at Symbian was responsible for the UI and the applications, and he became Symbian's first designer, responsible for the platforms and so on. And at the time, there was this great big religious war going on about, will people have two boxes or will they have one? Well, now we know that a lot of people have two boxes. The other box might be an iPod, because it does music better than a phone can do. And Cyan's former audience, lots of them have a BlackBerry or they have some Windows device just for email. But Nick Healy's comment was very astute, I thought. He said a great two box will be a good one box, and vice versa, a great one box will be a good two box. Cyan kind of made that decision that the market would be smartphones. We now know that's not true. Smartphones have been very disappointing sales compared to the projections earlier on. And I think the E90 actually embodies a very cynical design decision by Nokia. I find it quite atrocious. I call it the Cargo Cult Communicator. They're actually doing this thing on the cheap. If you remember what cargo cults are, they're South Pacific tribes who found themselves with US Air Force runways on their islands. And of course, these brought lots of cargo, and it was a very exciting thing. When the aeroplanes left, they tried to build runways, or things that they thought would be runways, to try and bring the aeroplanes back. So they sort of fashioned things out of objects to make it look like a runway. Nokia's E90 is a really horrible device. The hardware is well engineered, but I find it very insulting to put, as you say, menu that had 30 things hanging off one menu, but no accelerators. A lot of the kind of subtlety of the design has been lost, and I think, you know, we gain with smartphones, but we lose an awful lot too.
So let's put your crystal ball on the middle of the table. Let's go into that world of the 10,000 rabid fans. And Cyan did make the right choices and were brave in the choices. Where do you think they would be now? What do you think we would be using? Where would they be positioned in the world stage?
Well, some of the areas they looked at and didn't go into were set-top boxes.
Which, of course, Amstrad are now doing reasonable business with.
Yeah, and Pace, yeah. And hard disk-based music players, which I gather are quite popular.
Seen them around, yep.
and sat-nav systems. Now, two of Cyan's staff, David Tutman, went to Apple in 2001 after the layoffs and helped put together the iPod. Mark Gretton, who I mentioned earlier, went to TomTom, and TomTom was really, I don't want to say two guys in the garage, but it was a software company doing stuff for a tiny market.
And they knew exactly where the garage was.
And Mark built hardware from basically nothing. So this piece of hardware did phenomenally well using Cyan Computer's former managing director. Cyan's former export person is the marketing, and Mark and his engineering team include a lot of old Cyan stuff. TomTom last year turned over to, I think there are $2 billion either last year or this year. I have to check the numbers. I think this year's on course for about 1.6 billion euros. So that's a business created out of nothing. The only thing Cyan did, ironically enough, is the smallest market of all, which was the Wavefinder player. People described it as a very Cyan product. Not quite perfect, but really radical design, years ahead of its time.
And of course, it's a digital radio, which is now being shipped out by the bucket load, or doing its best to be shipped out.
So Cyan could have been really a British Sony or a British General Electric, and I find it's an awful shame. We almost want companies to fail in this country, and I find it depressing when people look to California in the assumption that great technology has to be made by Apple. Well, I lived in California for 7 years. I didn't see any engineering that we can't do.
And we're sitting here, you know, in the bar just round from Paddington, what, a couple of stones throw away from where Cyan used to be?
That's right.
I mean, this could have been, I dread to say this, but the Apple of North London.
An Apple for the world, yeah. I mean, the reason I think Sony comparisons are worthwhile is because Cyan had one thing that a lot of other companies don't have, and even companies with great engineers, and that's an absolutely fantastic product design partnership. This time with Martin Ridderford at Therefore, which was started with venture funding from Cyan itself. I mean, everyone kind of, Jonathan Ives at Apple is almost a household name. But Martin Ridderford had this way of not only producing mechanical designs, but designs that are just connected with the public. Now, this is the difference between like a company full of great, you know, geek engineers who can do amazing things, and a company that can make great products. So I think the comparison with Sony is a valid one. And in the end, I think the conclusion, as Mark said, Mark really provided the core of the piece, is that Cyan was once fearless and it became completely fearful of the competitors. Once it never looked at competitors to decide what to do, and then it became so beset by a loss of courage and faith in its own abilities that it just felt it couldn't win anywhere it looked, except for the industrial market.
Which, and let's be fair, Cyan Technologic are now, you know, they're doing very healthy turnover market at Cyan Technologic. The people who still have Cyan shares are doing nicely out of them. And, you know, they're all quite happy with their 2 or 3% growth per year.
Yeah, it's a nice, healthy business, but it was a sideways step, almost a backward step for what might have been.
So where are we now? We don't have Cyan anymore. We have their stepchild, as it were, with Symbian, which itself has had a tumultuous 4 or 5 years, which you really need to get round to doing as well. Find somebody from Finland to spill everything. But how do you see Symbian situated now? Obviously, we're all about Symbian here. Might think it looks quite rosy, 125 million devices out there. But when you compare that to the billions of mobile phones that are sold every year, when you look at things like market penetration, battery life, and people who are just using a phone as a phone.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? Are they still just a really expensive R&D shop for geeks?
I think that there's a problem with smartphones that I don't want to single out Symbian in any particular way. In fact, it may well be the case that they're doing as well as they possibly can, given that they've got this particular ownership, which is a group ownership in which one company kind of dominates the other. It's a very awkward political situation. I don't want to single anybody out in particular, but it's the fact that the technology manufacturer, it's only a component in a larger system. Now, the reason that, and it's doing amazing work, I think the real-time kernel that Dennis May's team put together at Symbian is one of the great British engineering achievements. And the legend goes that Dennis was writing this at home on his Series 5, was told he'd be sacked if it carried on. The project sort of fell behind the radiator for several years, and then years later the phone manufacturers go, wouldn't it be great if we did a real-time operating system? Wouldn't it be great if we had multiple personalities? Wouldn't it be great if these personalities could run our phone stacks? So it was down and dusted, and that in itself was great. The problem is, it's just that the economic model which produces all these gadgets, all these bling gadgets, doesn't seem to favour manufacturers who really care about the attention to detail in their product. And it's actually not a smartphone or even a phone business problem. If you've tried to get your washing machine or vacuum cleaner fixed recently, you'll know this. People will quote you more for the repair cost than for a replacement. And that's the kind of nature I alluded to a bit, the way capital was working now. But capital flows to manufacturing, and it's, you know, labour is still relatively expensive. So it's got this horrible throwaway culture that we have. Fixing stuff is really expensive. And I'll give you an example. There was a guy who used to work for Nokia. I better not say where, but he was very senior in his job, and he left a while ago, and he said one of the things that depressed the team more than anything was that they knew that they could only fix a tiny percentage of the bugs that a phone has, because the phone would be obsolete. It's very expensive to run new firmware through operators, and so he was working on worse and worse products. And that's just an unfortunate situation where the customers of the phones are the carriers, and they have one set of priorities, but the poor buggers who actually use them are us. And we have to put up with the bugs and the bad design.
There is a company that's launching a phone today that has an attention to detail, that is confident in its marketing, that is fearless, that will not look anybody in the eye and back down. And that, of course, is the Apple iPhone. Now, obvious. I'm one of these people that look at it and just get turned off mainly by the marketing and the fanboys. But if we can get that aside, I mean, Apple's attempting to do something that certainly Nokia have never been able to do, which is to get a beachhead in the US market and change the attitude of the operators. So, I mean, how do you feel Apple is going to deal with the operators, and how do you feel the iPhone in its first generation is going to pan out over the next couple of months?
Apple is actually marketing the iPhone in the same way it's approaching the digital download business, which is to generate such hype that it steamrollers all these people into submission. I don't know if you know the apocryphal story, which I've heard is true, but these are all rumours, I can't back them up, that when Steve Jobs was launching the iTunes music store, he didn't actually have a single contract written from all the four major labels to go ahead and launch it. Every time they sent one through to Cupertino, he just threw it in the bin, and he went ahead and launched anyway. About a month after this, one of the biggest label had this meeting, and similar meetings are going on at the other labels, going, well, what should we do now? This is really embarrassing. And Steve did that to set the price he wanted at 99, because they all had different prices for what a digital download should be. What he's doing with the iPhone is kind of steamrolling it market by market. But I think this is one thing to do in America, where people look to Apple as almost like a religious icon that has to deliver so often. It's going to find it very difficult to do it in the European market. Also, they're going to have to add some buttons to it, because if you've ever used a phone without buttons, it's really hard.
So with the iPhone coming out, and rumours possibly of T-Mobile, rumours of Vodafone, do you think it's going to make the same impact here? I mean, we're seeing talk plans being quoted in America between $18 and $120 per month for the Apple talk plans.
Sorry, how much again, Ewan?
Between $80 to $120 a month for the Apple data plans to go with AT&T's two-year contract for your iPhone. I've surprised Andrew with the prices.
You have? Yes, I haven't been paying attention to the iPhone at all. I find it very depressing, this relentless hype. It's a very, very different market to the UK, even compared to the rest of Europe. Europe is a very different market to the United States. Apple can kind of do this, and I think it will drive. Let's look at things in the third quarter. I've always said I want the iPhone to do well, because it will raise the standard for other people. It will make other manufacturers care about the finished article much more than it used to. But I I don't see it doing terribly well. The genius of Apple with the iPhone is that it's actually a defensive measure disguised as an offensive one, but in that sense it's worked, in that it's got all the rivals running around in a state of panic.
And as also case of it, it's almost like Wall Street and the shareholders were expecting it. So it's we better do something then.
Exactly. If they didn't do it, Wall Street would be hammering them, saying, look, music players are in phones. They outsell you already. When are you going to do something?
And going back to the first-gen iPod, to steal the words of Paul Cuff, it was a bag of shit. Relatively speaking.
I'm not sure if it was bad, but I remember it came out in the UK and it was £500 for 5 megabytes of storage. I think Apple's got a bigger problem than the economics of the phone business to contend with, and that's, where do you actually want your music to live? Is it going to be a service? I think music is turning into a service. You don't necessarily need a big cache of your stuff to be carried around with you. It's nice to have that collection, but if you have the certainty that when you clicked a button you could always get hold of it, that's a much more flexible model, and people like Omniphone have done a fantastic job with theirs, getting really good content for it and a really good service. It's streaming and it's music as a service, and I think they're way ahead of Apple on that.
I mean, certainly we could delve into music for a huge amount of time, but we are not all about digital downloads behind the DRM'd Maginot line of iTunes or Windows DRM. We're here for Symbian, but he's waving and gesticulating his music fan's hat on. Okay, go on then.
No, I was just going to say the Cyan article is available as a PDF download from today for the bargain price of $2.99. Now, there's a story here in which we devised possibly the world's most sophisticated DRM system, which is a USB dongle, which actually, if you even try and open the file, it sprays your computer with hydrochloric acid. And then sprays you with chapati flour. But unfortunately, we just couldn't get this finished in time. We were going through lots of staff who were being disfigured and wanted to sue us. So it's basically just a DRM-free download of the wonderful Cyan feature.
Well, there we go. Andrew Orlowski, soon to be the scriptwriter in Eli Roth's The Register. From that sort of trap, but Andrew, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ewan.
Okay, and All About Symbian podcast, as always, feel free to leave your comments back at www.allaboutsymbian.com. regular magazine format. We'll be back next week unless we can find somebody even more exciting and riveting than Andrew to join me, or indeed if Andrew steals a microphone and finds someone to interview himself and usurps me. But until then, run the music. You've been listening to the All About Symbian podcast, www.allaboutsymbian.com, copyright 2006.